The CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
It's finally fall. The weather is cooling off, and there's no better time to upgrade your cookouts than right now. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a huge menu of steaks and more. The process is convenient and quick, shopping delivered straight to your door. Every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. And right now, you can get the limited-time family grill pack for just $49.99. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 4-ounce Gourmet Jumbo Franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha Steakhouse Fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, OS seasoning packet, plus 4 additional Omaha Steaks Burgers. Just for listening, Omaha Steaks is offering all of this for only $49.99. This is a huge savings. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter code FTN in the search bar, and add the Family Grill Pack to your cart. Don't miss this deal. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get over 30 gourmet items for just $49.99.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Less than 3 weeks since Election Day, Donald Trump, the president-elect, is putting together his team of nominees. High-level, mid-level, in fact, the executive branch includes thousands of political appointees. He was interviewing people who want influential jobs. Perhaps it was like his old TV show, The Apprentice. He spoke to some at Trump Tower in New York City, his home, now with high security all around. Last weekend, at a Trump golf course in New Jersey, he did some interviews. And this holiday weekend, he's at his home in Palm Beach, Florida, a mansion and membership club with very high dues called Mar-a-Lago. We'll have coverage in the minutes ahead, and later CBS's Jan Crawford on Barack Obama's Happy Day Tuesday, awarding the Medal of Freedom to artists and others he adores and respects.
An emotional Ellen DeGeneres was acknowledged for her courage coming out almost 2 decades ago.
What an incredible burden that was to bear. To risk your career like that. People don't do that very often.
And a lot more ahead on this Weekend Roundup. I'm Dan Revive at CBS News in Washington. Let's consider how the president-elect, Mr. Trump, is announcing his decisions as he puts together his administration. He's to be sworn in on Inauguration Day, January 20th. This past Monday, he released a video message assuring Americans that the transition is going well and saying he definitely will pull out from a trade agreement that over a dozen Asian countries had been counting on as a way of selling more to the U.S., in some cases buying American products. That deal called TPP that was meant to box out China. Mr. Trump says instead he'll negotiate one-on-one with each nation for deals that'll help American workers. More in this report by CBS News national correspondent Chip Reed.
I've asked my transition team to develop a list of executive actions we can take on day one to restore our laws and bring back our jobs. It's about time.
President-elect Donald Trump outlined his plan for his first 100 days in office, including withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, loosening restrictions on energy production, and cutting regulations. He also promised a hard look at the visa program.
On immigration, I will direct the Department of Labor to investigate all abuses of visa programs that undercut the American worker.
Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, a potential pick for Secretary of Homeland Security, was seen holding a document titled Strategic Plan for First 365 Days. A leading critic of illegal immigration, his plan calls for adding extreme vetting questions for high-risk aliens and reducing the intake of Syrian refugees to zero.
And Chip Reed reported on Tuesday's visit by the president-elect to a newspaper he's always called failing, but now says it's a jewel of journalism he's hoping to get along with.
Mr. Trump was all smiles after a closed-door meeting with the New York Times, where reporters live-tweeted nearly every minute, exposing significant shifts in policy.
If I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor,
including his long-standing promise to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Hillary Clinton's use of private email servers as Secretary of State.
That would be a very good first step. That's a good first step.
One reporter tweeted that Mr. Trump said, "I don't want to hurt the Clintons. I really don't. She went through a lot and suffered greatly in many different ways." Later, he added, "I think it would be very, very divisive for the country." He also seemed to change his tune on climate change from a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese.
A lot of it's a hoax.
To a phenomenon linked to human activity. Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, is the former head of the conservative website Breitbart, who, in an interview with Mother Jones magazine last summer, said, "We're the platform for the alt-right, a conservative movement popular with white nationalists." Asked about the alt-right Tuesday, Mr. Trump told The Times, "I don't want to energize the group, and I disavow the group."
I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
That was Trump on torture, but yesterday he told The Times he was surprised that General James Mattis, the candidate he is seriously considering for defense secretary, didn't favor it, leaving the door open for a change. Mattis is one of a number of leading cabinet contenders.
Trump also revealed he may get his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, involved in the Middle East peace process. Kushner has been a close advisor to the president-elect throughout the campaign and key in his outreach to the Jewish community. Yesterday, Trump told Times reporters he'd love to be the one to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict, and Kushner could help.
Those reports by Chip Reed. Now to CBS News correspondent Anna Werner looking into how Donald Trump might divide his business interests from his role as president, or might not.
New York Times reporters quoted Mr. Trump as saying when it comes to conflicts of interest, the law favors him and that the president can't have a conflict of interest. But this law professor says that's not true.
Well, he's wrong because the president has an obligation to act in all things for America first, in his words.
Brian Quinn is from Boston College.
When there is the prospect, even the likelihood, that his private business interests can affect his decision-making, then it's hard for citizens to really believe that in all things he is acting for America first and not for his own personal interests.
Donald Trump's interests and businesses span 59 properties in at least 12 other countries, everything from residential towers to golf courses to hotels.
One, two, three.
The Trump Organization has said management of the businesses will transfer to Mr. Trump's children when he becomes president.
This is big league stuff.
On 60 Minutes, he said the country will be his priority.
I don't care about hotel occupancy. It's peanuts compared to what we're doing.
But Mr. Trump's transition activities have raised questions. The president-elect was photographed at Trump Tower last week with three of his Indian business partners. While the Trump camp later claimed it wasn't a meeting, only a brief exchange of hellos, it drew attention in India.
It wasn't received much like the way it was received here.
Tanvi Madan is an Indian foreign policy expert with the Brookings Institution.
One thing it definitely did was increase the visibility of both the Trump projects, but also these Indian business partners within the Indian media.
There's also Ivanka Trump's presence at a meeting between her father and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And an Argentine spokesman from the president's office says Ivanka Trump said hello to Argentine President Mauricio Macri at the end of a congratulatory call between the Argentine leader and Mr. Trump last week. New York Times reporters said Mr. Trump told them on Tuesday, "If it were up to some people, I would never ever see my daughter Ivanka again." Quinn says removing conflicts for Mr. Trump means separating himself from his businesses.
Merely turning over management of the businesses while he maintains a financial interest in all of them is not going to be sufficient to allay any sort of conflict. Every dollar that gets invested or spent or raised by the business through sales is a dollar that goes into his pocket, or some portion of it goes into his pocket, even if his children are managing the business.
Now, that law professor says the Constitution does set limits on a president's ability to gain other compensation above his usual pay, but the only people who can take action on that are members of Congress through impeachment processes.
With Republicans controlling both houses of Congress, that's not considered at all likely. Coming up, Barack Obama gave out medals to Tom Hanks, other actors, musicians, sports stars, in all 21 notable Americans. And other stories coming up on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Clearly a pleasure for Barack Obama, who will end his 8 years as president on January 20th. The ceremony at the White House this past Tuesday, in which he put a star-shaped medal on a blue ribbon around the neck of 21 Americans, including Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. But mainly, it seemed, people Mr. Obama really likes in the arts, including actors Robert Redford and Robert De Niro, and music stars such as Diana Ross and Bruce Springsteen. CBS News correspondent Jan Crawford was covering.
This is a particularly impressive class.
From a Redford to a Ross to the Boss, the 21 recipients of this year's Medal of Freedom painted a portrait of America's talent and diversity.
Everybody on this stage
has touched me in a very powerful personal way.
This was President Obama's final opportunity to honor Americans for their contributions to the U.S. and the world. Actor Tom Hanks was acknowledged for more than his Oscar-winning roles.
He's been an accidental witness to history. He's championed our veterans, supported space exploration. And the truth is, Tom has always saved his best roles for real life.
The president honored Michael Jordan and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He says Abdul-Jabbar wasn't just an MVP on the basketball court.
When a sport changes its rules to make it harder just for you, you are really good.
To me, it means I must have done something good in my lifetime or inspired a few people.
An emotional Ellen DeGeneres was acknowledged for her courage coming out almost two decades ago.
What an incredible burden that was to bear, to risk your career like that.
Her challenge Tuesday wasn't coming out, but getting in. She tweeted, "They haven't let me into the White House yet because I forgot my ID." As for Bruce Springsteen, Obama had to admit,
"I am the president. He is the boss."
Also among the honorees, actress Cicely Tyson, architect Frank Gehry, Vietnam Memorial designer Maya Lin, and just retired Dodgers announcer Vin Scully.
Now also at the White House Tuesday was Saturday Night Live producer Lorne Michaels, among others. According to a tally by the Washington Post, President Obama has given out more Medals of Freedom than any other president.
More than 110 Medals of Freedom in his 8 years. What a shock in Chattanooga, Tennessee on Monday. A school bus crashed. Police say it was going way too fast. Five children were killed. One had been in kindergarten, the oldest in fourth grade. Others were in critical condition. CBS's Manuel Bajorquez reported from a hospital.
Doctors say that after Monday's violent wreck, many of the children treated here were either too scared or dazed to spell their names or remember their own birthdays. All of this among reports that parents had previously complained about the bus driver.
The detective asked me what my child had on and said, "Your baby's deceased."
Jasmine Mateen recalls the agony when she learned her 6-year-old daughter, Zaira, was among the five children killed on board this Woodmore Elementary school bus.
She wanted to be a doctor, and now my baby can't be that doctor that she wanted to be.
The investigation into this deadly wreck has now turned to the bus driver, 24-year-old Jonathan Walker. Charged with 5 counts of vehicular homicide, police say Walker was driving well over the 30-mile-per-hour speed limit. He received his commercial driver's license in April and was involved in a minor bus crash just 2 months ago. Walker's mother says she spoke with him after the crash.
He said, "I love you, Mom. I've been in an accident on the bus." And he said, "Mom, the kid's dead. I hope it's not my fault."
The NTSB will examine the bus's black box to determine the driver's actions leading up to the crash. They'll also look into whether seat belts could have prevented death.
The bus was not equipped with passenger seat belts. Our mission is to understand not just what happened, but why it happened.
Only 6 states require seat belts on school buses. Tennessee is not one of them. Nationwide, an estimated 4 children die every year in large school bus crashes. Parents in this stunned community are struggling with how to explain this tragic news to their children.
And it's just so sad, you know. There's no words.
Manuel Bajorquez reporting on Wednesday. Now, more proof, if needed, that it can be dangerous to be a cop. A Detroit police officer was shot in the head while on patrol near a university campus Tuesday night. On Sunday, police officers in Missouri and in Texas were ambushed. A St. Louis officer badly wounded. In San Antonio, an officer was killed. CBS's Omar Villafranca is there. He reported police arrested a suspect, a man who told reporters he was angry because a judge in Texas, in family court, didn't let him see his son.
I've been through several custody battles, and I was upset at the situation I was in. I lashed out at somebody that didn't deserve it.
Do you have anything to say to his family?
Sorry.
Otis Tyrone McCain expressed remorse Monday night after being arrested by police. He was spotted riding on the interstate in a white car. a woman was driving, and a 2-year-old was also inside the sedan when police stopped him east of San Antonio.
We had him under surveillance, and at the appropriate time, the SWAT unit made the stop and arrested him without incident.
Investigators say McCain is the man seen in this surveillance video entering police headquarters on Sunday. About 4 hours later, police say he approached Detective Benjamin Marconi during a traffic stop outside headquarters, shooting him twice in the head. Although a motive is still unknown, police believe McCain targeted Marconi because of his uniform. The Sunday shooting in San Antonio was one of 4 separate attacks on police across the country. The number of officers killed in the line of duty nationwide is up 17% compared to the same time last year. In a statement on Monday, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said her department is, quote, working closely with our partners in the field to improve officer safety and resilience.
That from Omar Villafranca in San Antonio. Here's something for you to think about. If you go to a shopping mall this holiday weekend, tens of millions of Americans will do just that, hunting for bargains. But if they don't pay attention in the mall's parking lot, there could easily be a car crash or pedestrians getting injured. Or they're killed. Here's CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve, who got hold of some shocking pictures.
No surprise here. The number one culprit for distraction in a parking lot is the cell phone. Experts say we all have a false sense of security because of the slow speeds cars are traveling in parking lots, but the consequences of distraction can still be deadly.
The National Safety Council found, on average, at least 500 die in 50,000-plus crashes in parking lots and garages every year.
51 people die in parking lot accidents that involve cars backing up. Experts say, particularly this time of year where it's getting dark earlier and people are increasingly wearing dark winter coats, it's worth taking a second to double-check before you back up or use that backup camera.
Coming up, appropriate for the holiday weekend, reports about food and drink. The first one features a celebrity model. CBS's Howard Arenstein will be right back with that on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. For most of us, Thanksgiving is all about food. And this holiday weekend, we celebrate the foods we love. Prosecco sparkling wine is a sure bet for many festive tables. And model Christie Brinkley is promoting her new brand of the wine. She let correspondent Mark Phillips have a tasting.
You can't even say bellissima without... Bellissima, you know, just...
Without wanting a drink, Bellissima is her very own wine label. A new range of Prosecco, the Italian fizz that's about the hottest thing in the liquor business right now. U.S. sales are up about a third each year lately.
You are tasting nature, not chemicals.
And
not
Christie Brinkley and her partners think they found a way to break through the market clutter. Her.
Yes.
Prosecco, long the pre-dinner tipple in Italy, is being marketed in the U.S. as a kind of champagne without the pretensions and without the price tag. More bubbles for the buck.
Were you a Prosecco girl before you got involved in the Prosecco business?
Oh, yeah, I've had my fair share.
In the Veneto region of Italy, about an hour north of Venice, where anything that calls itself Prosecco has to come from, they can't make enough of the stuff.
It's really happening right now. Everybody wants Prosecco.
If you're going to get into the wine business, this is the place. And this is where Christie has come.
You tell a decent bunch of grapes from any other bunch of grapes.
Well, all our Bellissima grapes are gorgeous.
That one was.
She's not only found a wine she likes, Christie Brinkley seems to have found the fountain of youth.
Oh, yeah.
She's 62 years old. going on 22 by the look of her.
I have been around a long time.
It has been 37 years since she became the nation's pinup girl, appearing on three consecutive Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue covers, the only time anybody's ever done that. And her life has been like a timeline of the boomer generation, if a little more glamorous. Not everybody has a pop star husband in whose music video you can more or less play yourself.
I have a theme song, you know, wherever I go.
Billy Joel was one of four husbands and four divorces. Too good, too bad, she says. There were three children along the way.
This is authentic skincare.
Christy has used her fame in product promotion before. There's the skincare line.
With a nice stretch.
And gym equipment.
Total gym.
And in keeping with the always look your best theme, her fans may be pleased to know the new Prosecco range is organic and includes a sugar-free option.
It's zero sugar. It's zero carbs. This is safe for people with diabetes.
What the world needs, Diet Prosecco.
Diet Prosecco.
Down the hatch.
Correspondent Mark Phillips toasting with model Christie Brinkley and her new Prosecco, Bellissima. And now correspondent Jim Axelrod at the place many believe America's whole eat-out food industry began, Delmonico's Steakhouse in New York City.
It's noon in the kitchen of Delmonico's in Lower Manhattan.
Strip medium, filet medium, burger medium.
And head chef Billy Oliva has more than just today's lunch rush on his mind.
It's challenging. A lot of those famous dishes that were invented here, the lobster Newburgh, chicken a la quine. How do we keep people and you know, grandchildren and great-grandchildren of people that used to come here, how do we keep them interested in those dishes? That's my biggest challenge here.
Is to take the history
and bring it forward.
Delmonico's is the nation's first formal restaurant. So in many ways, this kitchen is the birthplace of what's grown into a $780 billion industry. Its influence on our nation's menus is unmistakable. Eggs Benedict, Baked Alaska, and of course, the Delmonico's steak all made their name here.
So when people say Delmonico's steak, that's this guy. Wet age, boneless ribeye.
Is Delmonico's steak sold all over the country? There's only one place that carries such meaning.
It's right here.
And with a history that dates back to 1837.
Look, we're going to Delmonico's for supper. Won't you join us?
Lunch at Delmonico's.
Join me at Delmonico's on Sunday instead.
Delmonico's fingerprints are on more than just our menus.
Most presidents, Diamond Jim Brady, Vanderbilt's, Abraham Lincoln ate here.
Abraham
Lincoln. Teddy Roosevelt ate here.
That's right.
In his new book, Yale historian Paul Friedman has come up with the 10 restaurants that changed America.
Delmonico's almost like Kleenex or Xerox became shorthand for restaurant.
That's right.
But all 10 make up a delicious part of our cultural history.
So to understand how we go out to eat is to understand how we live, and that's to understand who we are.
And how we think, how we look at the world, what sorts of things we desire, and how we distinguish ourselves as Americans.
Restaurants like Mama Leone's, which integrated ethnic food into the mainstream, and the Mandarin in San Francisco, which elevated it beyond chop suey. Sylvia's in Harlem and Antoine's in New Orleans, the influence of regional cuisine. How the highbrow shaped eating out. Le Pavillon, Chez Panisse, the Four Seasons. And how the middle brow did as well. Schraff's and Howard Johnson's.
On the road around the corner, here's the place to go.
Howard Johnson's?
In the roof of Howard Johnson's, join the folks who know.
Howard Johnson's is the basis for not only the fast food industry like McDonald's or Burger King, but the fast casual industry like Chili's or Denny's.
It's going to be $6.15.
Americans now spend more money on eating out than on buying food to cook at home. And even if you never step foot in the place that started it all, don't ever forget, your favorite neighborhood joint has a lot more in common than you might think with iconic restaurants like Delmonico's.
Correspondent Jim Axelrod on this special Thanksgiving weekend edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
That's Howard Arenstein. We know many of you, more than usual, are on the road, so please be careful. The main message from our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
I was out recently in the afternoon to vote. Driving to the local polling place, a car passed me, easily going 100 miles per hour. This was in a low-speed school zone. The driver was either drunk or has a death wish or both. It's just a matter of time before tragedy will strike. Please don't do that. The life you save will at least be your own. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
We hope you're having a safe and happy Thanksgiving weekend. And please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. We're celebrating food this Thanksgiving holiday weekend, and museum cafeterias are not usually known for food as fine as the paintings in the gallery. But correspondent John Blackstone found an exception.
At San Francisco's recently expanded Museum of Modern Art, record crowds have been feasting their eyes on the works of contemporary masters like Ellsworth Kelly, Frank Stella, and Andy Warhol. And then feasting themselves on the works of master chefs like Wiley Dufresne and Dominique Ansel.
I think this is an idea that seems so obvious once you think about it.
Chef Corey Lee reimagined the museum restaurant as another museum gallery.
There are a lot of people who kind of stumble in here and they sit down and they're like, what is this?
The restaurant called In Situ offers diners signature dishes of some of the world's most celebrated chefs.
They open this menu that looks like a museum program, and they start seeing dishes from around the world with dates on them, and I think it's disorienting for them.
Something they didn't expect, but it surprises them.
And continues the experience of discovery that they were having in the museum, but with food.
Lee is a celebrated chef himself. His three Michelin-star restaurant menu is just blocks away. But the 37-year-old does not serve any of his own creations at In Situ.
I've come to think of Corey as our curator of food.
SF MoMA's director, Neil Benezra, chose Lee to design a museum-worthy restaurant.
He had a wonderful amount of curiosity about what we do, how our curators work, how these pictures come to be on our walls. So I explained to him that if we wanted to do an exhibition of Klaus Oldenburg, our curator would try to identify the best works of art by that artist and try to bring them to our museum.
I wanted to do the same thing with food. And so a diner can come in here and try a dish from the chef in Belgium and this chef in Japan, the chef in Hong Kong. They can have this very fun and kind of new experience with food.
Chefs from all over the U.S., Europe, and Asia have visited In Situ, teaching the kitchen staff to reproduce their dishes perfectly.
Correspondent John Blackstone in California. Across the country now to Connecticut, where CBS's Mo Rocca met a nun who knows all about one of America's favorite foods, cheese.
Seven times a day, the Benedictine nuns of the Abbey of Regina Laudis gather for prayer and the singing of the Psalms. This is their way of communing with the Lord. So is the work they do in this cloistered community in the Connecticut town of, wait for it, Bethlehem. Although she might deny it, the big cheese among the 38 sisters is Mother Noella, a revered international authority on traditional cheese making.
Did you eat a lot of cheese growing up?
No, we didn't. I think we probably had provolone.
Born Martha Marcellino, she entered the Abbey in 1973.
I was a college dropout. I went to Sarah Lawrence. I went there because it was the most radical school in the country. When you join an abbey, you get to try many things you never would have done. Mm-hmm. And I happened to fall in love with a cow named Sheba and then learned to make cheese.
In 1977, Mother Noella started making raw milk cheese. But her early efforts didn't quite slice it, so she prayed for a teacher.
I was praying for an old French woman to teach me. But a young one came, and her grandmother taught her how to make this cheese.
So, in a sense,
yes,
your prayers were answered.
They were definitely answered.
What's made here is called Bethlehem cheese.
This is the most beautiful mold right there.
Wheels of it age in the Abbey's tiny cheese cellar.
And this right now is a young cheese made only 4 days ago, so you wouldn't want to eat this now. It would be rubbery.
Mother Noella sees in a wheel of cheese a world beyond our own.
CBS's Mo Rocca in Connecticut, and correspondent Lee Cowan went to Hawaii to find out about one of the most exotic seasonings that's no longer just sitting on the shelf.
Not far from the surfer's paradise of Hanalei on Kauai's North Shore grows a spice as golden as a Hawaiian sunrise that might just offer our bodies the same kind of healthy glow. It's called turmeric, a member of the ginger family, that before it's washed, looks a bit like an ugly carrot. Turmeric is not a root, but a rhizome, which means its stem is where all the good stuff is found. Native to India, turmeric has been around for thousands of years, but only recently has caught on here in the West. Now, people can't get enough.
This year, do you know how many thousands of pounds of turmeric you're going to ship out?
Tonnage. Major tonnage.
Phil Green and his wife Linda bought this 45-acre farm over a decade ago.
Oh, man, this is a beautiful day, isn't it?
Yeah.
They had planned a semi-quiet retirement.
How many buckets we got, Uncle?
Until turmeric became one of the most talked-about new superfoods.
Did you know what it was?
Barely. To me, turmeric was a powdered spice in a jar that stayed on your shelf until you made a curry recipe, you know.
Curries are its most common use, but turmeric's taste is only part of its allure. Scattered to the wind, it's a sacred part of Hindu ceremonies. It's also been used as a dye for fabrics. It's even what gives mustard its bright yellow hue. But the very thing that makes turmeric so colorful, a compound called curcumin, is what some researchers say also makes it a powerful weapon against disease.
We are doing clinical trials on Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, arthritis, diabetes.
Biophysicist A.J. Goyle has been studying its medicinal qualities at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. He says thousands of studies have shown that in a concentrated enough dose, the curcumin in turmeric is not only proven to be an effective antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, but also shows promise in preventing and even treating something as serious as cancer.
We're trying to understand is what are the processes, what are the mechanisms, how it functions.
So you know it works for the most part, you're just not quite sure why.
Yes, so exactly.
While he says more research needs to be done, the word is already out at trend-setting restaurants like Cafe Gratitude in Los Angeles. Here, turmeric is mixed with steamed almond milk. Or blended into a shot, served with a dose of cayenne pepper.
That's going to be spicy. That's called I Am Brave. That has turmeric, ginger, lemon.
Whoa. Cafe Gratitude's co-owner, Ryland Engelhart.
In a petri dish, that can knock out, like, you know, diseases.
Yeah, it's got a kick.
Correspondent Lee Cowan in Hawaii. Stay with us on this special Thanksgiving holiday weekend edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
When you're opening a new office location, but deadlines don't let up, you need to make sure your team can start working fast, which means all of a sudden, you're looking to buy new conference tables, chairs, laptops, and whiteboards quickly. Business cards from American Express Open can give you buying power to help cover the big purchases you need to make when you need to make them. Find out how American Express cards and services can help prepare you for growth at open.com.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. Let's talk about Israel, the small country which is America's chief ally in the Middle East. We turn to Daniel Gordis in Jerusalem, author of a new book called Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. Well, let's start with a fact. The population is about 8 million, and people may be surprised. Only 3/4 of them are Jewish. So have you included in this book, you know, what it's like to be a minority, a member of the Arab or Christian minority there?
Absolutely. In fact, I talk a lot about the ways in which Israel has granted the Israeli Arabs a significant number of rights that they would not have had in neighboring countries. But I'm equally focused on the ways in which Israel has not really lived up both to its promise and its obligations to the Arab minority.
So it's true that your book is not all positive. I have a feeling you love Israel because you moved there and you've decided to stay, but loving Israel doesn't mean you can't criticize it.
Yeah, I do love this country. I believe in the importance of this country, but I think that just like being an American citizen often means speaking about the ways in which America is not living up to its vision, the same thing is true about caring about Israel. And I tried to tell a story that focused both on the tremendous accomplishments, but also the ways in which Israel needs to do better.
The world assumes that the West Bank should be an independent Arab country to be called Palestine. And the world assumes that the Gaza Strip, now run by, well, pretty much a terrorist organization, Hamas, should be part of that new nation. The world assumes that. So you sit in Israel, you look at all the choices that the Israeli government and army, you know, faces. Is there going to be a nation of Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza?
I would like there to be, but I don't think it's about to happen anytime in the near future. We saw at the end of October when UNESCO voted twice to basically deny any Jewish connection to the land here, to the city of Jerusalem, to the old city, to the Temple Mount. As long as the international community is so clearly two-faced and doesn't even grant the Jewish people the acknowledgement that this is an ancestral home, then you're not going to get Israeli citizens to feel that they're going to be backed up by the international community and therefore get them to make the territorial concessions that peace is going to require. When the international community stops the pile-on, when the Palestinians state publicly and in Arabic that they believe that the Jews have a right to some land here, and now it's a matter of drawing a line, yeah, I think we actually can get to a peace agreement, but I think it's a long way off in the future.
You mentioned what the world thinks, but perhaps it's in Israel's own interest to have an Arab country of Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza.
I actually think that it is. I think it's in Israel's interest not to rule over the millions of Arabs who live in the West Bank and Gaza. That's clearly true. What Israelis have to try to figure out is how do you not rule over the West Bank and not have it turn into Gaza? As we know, Israel has been shelled massively at least 3 times since President Obama took office, and those led to 3 major wars, or at least 3 significant conflagrations. Israelis who want to get rid of the West Bank, who want it to become something other than an occupied territory, they just want to know that they can do that without facing missiles from the east side as well. When there is some solution to that problem or that threat seems to be mitigated, I think Israelis will embrace peace even if it means serious territorial concession.
Daniel, 15 years ago, the New York Times published some of what you wrote from Jerusalem at a time of great violence. There were suicide bombings by Palestinian attackers. The New York Times called them emails from an anxious state. Your emails these days, are you still in an anxious state of Israel?
Well, things are much more quiet than they were in 2000 to 2004. We're not dealing with bus bombings and restaurant bombings and suicide bombers everywhere. I think Israel actually is a very calm place these days. Israelis feel very secure. They're watching the north with ISIS and with the battles going on there. They're watching the south where the Egyptian border flares up periodically, very minorly so far. But yes, I think we are in a much calmer state. And part of what Israelis want to see happen is to see the calm remain, and at the same time hope that the various governments on various sides can begin to have the kinds of conversations that might move us closer to a long-term settlement.
That's Daniel Gordis, author of Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. In Jerusalem, Daniel Gordis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Now for parents here in the U.S. concerned about soccer at school, is that sport safe? We have a study of serious injuries sustained while playing soccer by young Americans in the past 24 years. The study done by the Center for Injury Research and Policy in Columbus, Ohio. Tracy Meehan, when did the injuries occur? Which part of the game?
A lot of the injuries we saw in our study came from the kids either running into each other, so colliding into each other, hitting the ball with their head or body part, or when they were running and twisted a knee or an ankle.
You write in the journal Pediatrics that the number of injuries each year in the U.S. is up 78% compared with 1990, and these aren't only slight injuries.
Our study looked at only the injuries that were serious enough to be treated in emergency departments. So we looked at the serious injuries. The good news is that most of them got treated and sent home that day. So there were really only about 2% who had to spend the night at the hospital. However, one of the things that really concerned us with our study was the increase in head injuries that we saw over the 25-year period.
How much of an increase?
1,600%. We went from, in 1990, seeing 1,589 head injuries to 22,750 in 2014. So that's 62 head injuries a day just from soccer.
And why do you think the number of serious injuries keeps rising?
We're seeing an increase in the number of injuries for a couple of reasons. Some of it is just increased awareness. People are a lot more aware of injuries and how severe they can be now, especially concussions. We've been hearing so much in the news about concussions recently. So some of that may just be increased awareness. It's not necessarily, in some cases, that more are happening, but that more are being reported and treated, which is a good thing. We want to see them treated. We're also, though, thinking that some of it is a result of the dramatic change in the way soccer is being played now. 25 years ago, you maybe played in a youth soccer league or even for your school, and you played for one season and you were done. Now, kids are playing year-round, often in multiple leagues at the same time. It's much more intense than it used to be.
And if you have any advice, especially to the parents of young people taking part in soccer, what would you say?
Kids can make sure that they are conditioned well so they can participate in a preseason conditioning program that works on building core muscles and strengthening neck muscles. You can make sure the kids always warm up before they play. Always wear the recommended protective gear like shin guards and mouth guards. And really important to follow and enforce the rules. We see a lot of injuries happen during illegal play or when coaches and referees aren't enforcing the rules. So just make sure you're following and enforcing the rules.
That's Tracy Meehan at the Center for Injury Research and Policy. That's at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Tracy Meehan, thank you.
Thanks.
Kids, parents, everybody, please be careful this holiday weekend. We hope Thanksgiving is terrific. Anytime you want to hear more, please do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. Also, use our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. Produced in Washington by CBS's Howard Arenstein, this has been the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Dan Revive.